Yes, sir. We're still here.
Thank you. Mr. Harmon, do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor. I think I want to just go forward.
All right. Good enough. We're ready when you are, sir.
May it please, Court. This case comes before the Court on the defense appeal of his convictions for second-degree murder and for possession of a firearm while committing a felony. That was before the Bristol, Virginia Circuit Court. In support of this appeal, the defendant alleges that the court erred when it failed to suppress text messages taken from the defendant's cell phone without probable cause in violation of the Supreme Court's recent ruling in Raleigh versus California and U.S. versus, and I'm probably mispronouncing this, Worry. In those cases, the Supreme Court basically set out to make a bright line rule that, in effect, says that if you're going to seek out digital data, you either need to have a search warrant or a showing of exigent circumstances. The Supreme Court in Raleigh versus California and Worry held that there was a distinction between the reasonableness and expectations of privacy in the cell phone, the physical cell phone itself, and the private nature of the information accessed through the cell phone. The court distinguished the cell phone from other types of searches incident to arrest.
Mr. Harmon,
this
is Judge Russell. In Riley, didn't the court hold that without any type of dispute that a police officer could pick up a cell phone, could seize the cell phone, could turn it off? And isn't that the contact that the trial court found that the officer engaged in this case prior to seeking the warrant?
Your Honor, yes, the court did distinguish between having a cell phone itself. They said, yes, you can look at the cell phone, make sure there's no weapons in there, but they distinguished between that and the information that is contained in the cell phone. And in this case, the officer had possession of the cell phone for 12 hours, Your Honor. She took it at around 12:30 in the evening, and it wasn't until the cell phone buzzed at 12:14 the next morning. Well, she took it at 12:30 at night and 12:14 the next morning until the time that she says she saw the messages. In this case, and I think the case is very similar to the Worry case, but I think that the court made this distinction between the physical ability to obtain the cell phone as part of a case where the officer is taking possession of it and being able to get into the information that was there.
Well, Mr. Harmon, in Worry, what the court detailed was that the police had to enter the phone and began hitting buttons to determine all the information that they ultimately determined. There is no, or at least the trial court appears to have found that none of that happened in this case, that she simply picked up the phone to turn it off and the message was apparent without her touching any buttons. If that's the case, aren't you outside of the Riley-Worry paradigm?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that the court found that she didn't touch any buttons. I don't think that her testimony was that she didn't touch any buttons. I think her testimony was that she tried to turn the phone off. We don't know exactly how many buttons she did touch. What we do know is that she says she saw a couple of three messages. Those messages, as I understand, basically were, "Are you okay?" She didn't basically provide any other additional information. And part of, I think, their concern in this case is that the detective then used that information and made this broad statement to the magistrate that those statements were somehow or another related or relevant to the crime that she was investigating. It was based on that information that she ultimately was able to get a search warrant. In the Worry case, the officers, by contrast, only had the cell phone for about 10 minutes. And yes, they did push a couple of buttons. And like I said, in this case, we don't know how many buttons the officer actually pushed. What the distinction that this court made was that her whatever she saw was accidental, not intentional. Not that she had attempted to see them, just that she happened to see them. And I think part of their problem with that is that it opens the door to a situation where the detective could just hold on to the phone indefinitely, where eventually she may be able to see something regardless. As I said, it was 12 hours from the time that she had taken possession of the phone till the time that, that she actually saw the messages.
It's Judge Russell again. You have touched on the concept of lack of probable cause based on what the officer testified she saw on the phone. At any point prior to trial, did you, in a written motion as required by statute, challenge the probable cause?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I want to advise the court that I wasn't trial counsel in this case. The trial counsel was fired at the end of the case.
Well, did trial counsel do that?
Well, all right. Your Honor, the trial counsel... And that certainly is an issue that was raised by the Attorney General in his brief, that there was a written suppression motion that was made. And that written suppression motion made a general objection to all information that was obtained on any cell phone that – I'm sorry, Judge, I'm kind of running through my notes here – any cell phone that was obtained from the defendant. They also then, later, in the defense written motion, in the prayer for release, defense counsel submit that the law enforcement obtained probable cause to obtain the search warrant by illegally examining the contents of the defendant's cell phone. It's the defense's position that this motion placed the issues of probable cause and the contents of the messages used by the police to obtain a search warrant squarely before the court. During oral argument on the suppression motion, the defense counsel was even more explicit. They directly questioned whether there was a nexus that exists believed between the alleged statement viewed by the detective and the existence of probable cause sufficient for the magistrate to make a finding. Now, unfortunately, that's the only thing that they did. Now, they did... during the trial, on the second day of the trial, renewed their objections, basically at the end of the Commonwealth's evidence, even citing to what they said was U.S. versus Worley, and I'm wondering if that wasn't U.S. versus Worley was what they were trying to cite to. But basically at that time, both the defense counsel and the court basically said, well, that involved a warrantless search and kind of passed on it. But defense counsel did renew their objection, and the court acknowledged that they were renewing their objections to the text messages, basically even throughout the trial.
But nowhere in writing pretrial did the defense say that the warrant lacked probable cause explicitly, correct?
I don't think they said that explicitly pretrial. Yes, Your Honor. I think that would be a fair statement. I would agree with that. Now, like I said, I think that they did bring up the argument during the suppression hearing, and I know that the Attorney General certainly cited the Gregory case, which that court basically made a specific ruling that the defense had not raised pretrial Miranda objections as part of their written motion. But this court made no such ruling, and as I said, certainly their position is that defense counsel did raise that, certainly during the suppression hearing, as part of their oral motions at that time. I think that also that we need to kind of go back again to where the court, the Supreme Court, certainly in the Riley and Worry cases, would talk about how the type of information that the cell phones contain is qualitatively and quantitatively different than the type of searches they're able to take from part of a search. That the cell phones contain information that would allow the police to be able to have information about very intimate parts of people's lives. They can track where people have been, they can see pictures, they can see what their calendar is, information that previously was never available as part of a search incident to arrest. And that's, I think, part of what the issue is here. Also, I think, you know, the court kind of said, well, where the officer only, you know, touched some things, that this is different than worry. And I think their position is that it's not because, or not significantly different, because in worry, the officers only pushed a couple buttons. And like I said, in this case, we don't know how many buttons Detective Simpson pushed. The type of information the officers had simply was to identify the phone number that was listed as home from the list of numbers on Mr. Worry's phone. In this case, the officers saw a number of different texts. In fact, the Attorney General in their argument makes kind of an argument that she may have seen as many as five texts that had been sent to Mr. Buchanan at that time, like I said, about noon, 12 hours after his arrest. As far as the issue of the search warrant, as I indicated, Detective Simpson's affidavit basically provide no factual basis to believe that evidence of the alleged crime existed within the data contained on the cell phone. She stated that Mr. Buchanan had made a statement admitting to the shooting, but she provided no facts that provide that anything involving the shooting was contained on the phone. She made a purely conclusory statement that there was information that was related to the crime on the phone, but that gave the magistrate absolutely no basis upon which to come to a decision. As I indicated before, the messages the Detective Simpson testified that she saw were, "Are you okay? From what I'm hearing, unless I hear from you." And these are the same sort of messages that any family member or friend might send to someone who they were out of contact with.
This is Judge Chafin. In reference to your argument, just let's assume for a moment that you're correct and there was not sufficient probable cause for the issuance. Then how does our good faith exception, discuss that for me just a moment, how that would not apply in reference to this case?
Well, Judge, first of all, Detective Simpson wasn't under any sort of extant circumstances. She basically was 2 days after the arrest that the search warrant was issued. She's a detective with substantial experience, and certainly she knows the difference between a factual allegation and a purely conclusory statement. Also, the detective knew that the statements themselves were innocuous and hardly related to the offense itself. It's well established that good faith does not apply where the magistrate was misled by the information in the affidavit, in which the affidavit knew or should have known that the information was false, that the issuing magistrate totally abandoned his judicial role. The warrant was based on an affidavit so lacking in indicia of probable cause as to render official belief in its existence unreasonable, or where the warrant was so facially deficient that an executing officer could not reasonably have assumed it was valid. In this case, the only information there that created any sort of nexus was, well, I saw messages and they're related. First of all, beyond the question about whether they actually were related or not, I think you have to say, how can the magistrate actually have come to a decision that those messages were related or not without knowing what the messages were?
Mr. Harmon, this is Judge Russell again. If a portion of the argument is that the detective's or the officer's statement in the affidavit was false, didn't there have to be a Franks hearing pretrial? And there wasn't one, was there?
No, Your Honor, there was not. There was not.
And so under Franks, isn't it waived?
I think that's arguable, Your Honor. As I said, I think the defense counsel did bring up the issue of lack of probable cause. The Attorney General raised the case of Tyson, and it's their position that case is not applicable in this case because that dealt with probable cause for an arrest. In this case, we're talking about probable cause for a search warrant. And the law is clear that a magistrate must find from the facts that substantial basis exists for finding a probable cause, being that a fair probability exists that the item sought will be found at the place to be searched. And that's a case to this court. Anzalota v. Commonwealth at 607 Southeast 2nd, 749, 44 Virginia, 764, Virginia Appellate, this court, 2005. As I've indicated, yes.
Mr. Harmon, if I can interrupt for a moment, this is Judge Hoff. You're within your last minute, and so if you could sum things up for us, I would appreciate it.
You know, the defense's position in this case is that Riley and Worry do apply, that the case is very close to Worry, and that there is no plain view exception that has been made, and in fact that but for the fact that the phone had been taken as part of a search incident to an arrest, it would not have been in the possession of the detective in the first place. Also, our position is that the search warrant on its face was defective. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Jeffrey?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Donald Jeffrey from the Attorney General's Office, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. I think the Court and opposing counsel have touched on most of the issues that we raised in our brief. The one sort of obvious one that's still lurking, I'll try to discuss briefly, is the concept of waiver, as most recently probably embodied in this court's decision in Isaacs, which was a 58 Virginia Appellate. I've cited that in the brief, and that while there are cross-examination and rebuttal exceptions to this rule about the same or similar evidence, those are pretty narrow exceptions, and this case is a textbook example, I think, of where someone has presented the objected to evidence on his own behalf, and specifically what you're dealing with here. And I've got citations in the brief for all the things, so I'm not going to inundate you with those things at this point. You've got a defendant on the one hand who's objecting to the admissibility of information from the cell phone that the Commonwealth wanted introduced in the hours immediately preceding the murder in this case, and in his own case in chief, and this would also include things that he argued and other various parts of the record. I think also there were some places on cross-examination as well. He clearly presented evidence of things that were sent about a week earlier, and essentially, if you look at the argument, and I think even some of the examination of the defendant, what you see is you sent these messages, I believe it was on the 11th, you didn't murder anybody that day, did you? You didn't murder anybody the next day, and this was all part of this, for lack of a more eloquent term, I'll use the defendant's term, this Billy Badass defense that he tried to raise at trial, and he was essentially using other text messages from unrelated dates to bolster this defense. And there's any number of cases, one of which I think is a pretty good example. I've cited some of them in the brief, but one that I didn't, that I believe is actually cited in Isaacs, is the Hubbard case from the Supreme Court of Virginia. And that was an accident reconstruction, and there was objection, as I recall, to the admissibility of the Commonwealth's evidence that the defendant's speed was, I believe, in excess of 90 miles an hour, and then the defense in his own case in chief, or her case, the defendant was female, in that case, puts on evidence, her own expert evidence, saying that she was only going, I believe, about 70 or 65 at the time of the collision in that case. And that's one example of the application principle. The Supreme Court there held it was clear waiver. It seems to me it's probably even more compelling here because the objection is to the admissibility of anything coming off of a cell phone, and then the defendant in this case then seeks to introduce this as evidence, as his own evidence. And one of the things that then-Judge Kelsey made a point of saying in the opinion is, you know, the mere fact that he's trying to rebut, or even the fact towards the end of the opinion, it talks about the fact that it's not some kind of but-for test that, you know, I only put this on because of what the Commonwealth put on. That does not extricate you from the application of this rule. So I think when you look at it in that perspective, that any Fourth Amendment challenge is waived. And that's probably a threshold issue given this court's past jurisprudence saying that you at least oftentimes try to avoid reaching potentially problematic constitutional issues if there's other ways to resolve the case. With respect to the probable cause default, yes, there was some snippet, I believe, on page 45 with respect to it where the argument was made, but it was a very limited snippet. It was not in the pretrial motion. Counsel does correctly state the holding of that case that I cited. You know, one thing that's factually distinguishable in that case is, and I sort of understand Judge Russell had picked up on that point, but he is correct when he tells you that what the actual issue in front of the court in that case was, we had a trial judge say, you've waived it by not raising it in your pretrial written motion. And this court was asked to address the issue of whether it was appropriate for the trial court to find waiver. So it's not exactly the same situation, but you take this all the way down to the end of the line, and what you've basically got is a very limited snippet of a few lines. It's very clear, the written motion, I don't believe, ever addressed this probable cause issue. I don't know that there's any real serious dispute about that. It was a very passing reference. And I think, importantly, when you're talking in terms of 5A18, you look at how the trial court and opposing counsel were construing what they believed was in front of the court. And if you look at the things, and again, I have citations in the brief for this, that was entirely construed as not having to have anything to do with the warrant itself. It was the things that preceded obtaining the warrant. And I did cite Reiner. It's a case I'm very familiar with because I was counsel in that case, which is a good example of a situation where perhaps where the correct argument was initially made by trial counsel, and the circuit court in that case only ruled on one portion of the argument, and ironically, the easier portion of it, but never got to the second tier of a hearsay issue that had probably, in fact, been correctly raised by counsel in the initial objection. And under those circumstances, the Supreme Court found waiver. And again, I think given the isolated nature of this reference here, probably application of that rule would be even more compelling in a case such as this as it was than it was in Reiner. So I would say that is waived.
Mr. Jeffrey, this is Judge Russell. On
yes, sir.
Turning to the merits themselves, if the trial court had found that the officer had to hit any button to access the text messages, that would be a problem under Riley, correct?
I don't want to give a very blanket answer to your question, Judge Russell, but may take it further than I mean to. I think clearly in the course, as I understood her testimony, in the course of what she believed was attempting to shut the phone down, she didn't initially get it shut down in these at least snippets of messages, which I think is a fair characterization of her testimony, appeared in front of her. I think, to follow up on some questioning that I heard earlier, I believe it was your questioning, under worry, if you look, they were trying to go into the contacts list, and I don't think there was any dispute. They were trying to get to things that were actually in the internal mechanism of the phone. But I would agree with you generally that if there were some evidence in the record that was credited by the trial court that she was attempting to access this digital data in any fashion, and whether that could be whether she admitted to it, whether he found her testimony not credible. You might remember that there was some conflicting testimony from the defendant himself, who the Commonwealth apparently graciously, although I think it was a tactical thing, quite frankly, basically allowed him to be qualified as an expert, and he opined that what she said wasn't possible. The trial court rejected that testimony at this point in denying the motion. So, but I think you're absolutely right. If there were evidence that she was actually trying to access the digital data in any fashion, I think in terms of Riley, we would be done. Now, we would have a number of other arguments here, but I agree with you. I hope I've answered your question.
You have.
Riley, I believe, is fairly clear on that, but it's equally clear on the use of these. I think the term is Faraday bags. That's not what was used at trial, but it is used in the U.S. Supreme Court opinion in Riley to turning the phones off and using these Faraday bags. And one of my colleagues characterized the paint cans as a poor man's Faraday bag, which I think is probably accurate, that the bag being named after the scientist who apparently came up with this notion. So those types of steps are eminently reasonable and were so found in Riley that the court mentioned it. And again, the court there also stated that, you know, essentially just taking the phone from an arrestee as a search incident is not problematic either. They based that on concessions that were made by the parties in the case, but they did say that those were reasonable concessions. I've certainly addressed the Fourth Amendment issues in terms of the merits of the probable cause on the brief. Again, we don't hold people to high drafting standards because of the lack of legal expertise, and admittedly there are a handful of law enforcement officers across the Commonwealth who actually are licensed members of the Virginia State Bar, but that's somewhat of an anomaly. No indication this particular officer was. And also, the sort of general preference we give to having warrants, and I cited you things in the brief about this, that we resolve doubtful cases in favor of issuance of warrants. And in any event, the good faith exception would salvage this because, as the Virginia Supreme Court put it, the reliance on the warrant has to be entirely unreasonable. And here you have somebody who, you know, she indicated she had personal knowledge. I think that Sixth Circuit case that the defendant tries to rely on made a big point of saying, we really don't know from this affidavit in this case whether this was based on her knowledge or a third-party informant in a lot of cases. And to the extent it was clear that it was involved in a third-party informant, it was also very clear that there wasn't much of a basis for pointing out how he might have knowledge of the things that they were relying upon him for, what sort of background or anything like that. Here, she indicated, based on the block that's on the form that we have in Virginia, that it was based on personal knowledge. She indicated she was seeking murder warrants, obviously, that there was an admission from the defendant and other things related to that. She did draw some inferences as to what these messages meant. I would suggest to you that even before you get to good faith, that's not entirely unreasonable the way this was written up. We don't hold them to really tight standards on this. And I also would suggest to you that the fact that those things could be construed innocently is not, for reasons I stated in the brief, a basis to find that what she did was unreasonable or that there was a Fourth Amendment violation, particularly given that she wasn't required to construe those messages in a vacuum. You know, if you grabbed my phone and said, are you okay? That's probably fairly innocuous, but if you have the phone of somebody who in very recent past has shot someone, it's perhaps an entirely different issue, and the inferences that flow from that she relied upon were not unreasonable on her part, which, again, is the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment analysis in any event. I don't know that there really was a whole lot said at trial. I know counsel's made a big point of the fact that they may have had her phone for over 12 hours, but I'm not certain that really was a big issue raised at trial in terms of the length. But again, given the state of the law from Riley, her taking it is not unreasonable, and keeping it secured in the police department, there's nothing to indicate that there's a Fourth Amendment violation there. It's really truly only when you're deliberately going after the digital data. And she's testified that it was inadvertent, the motion was denied, so at this point you have to presume that the trial court credited that testimony, and that would militate against any finding of the type of deliberate misconduct that would require suppression. If the court doesn't have any more questions on the Fourth Amendment, I'll turn briefly to the sufficiency. I tend usually to rely on my brief on something like that if opposing counsel hasn't had an opportunity to address it in his argument, and I'll be very brief with that here. I think what you've got essentially is an argument that the court should have credited or should have essentially found self-defense as a matter of law, and the counsel does accurately point out that there was forensic testimony from the medical examiner that would contradict what the defendant's version of events was. And during cross-examination, some of which, frankly, I found somewhat confusing. There were some questions about could the slope of the terrain there have affected his analysis on that. But that was all stuff that was before the jury. They had pictures of the crime scene. They could view that for themselves. And actually, something I just picked up on when I was reviewing for this argument today is that in his own testimony, the defendant, and I'll give you, I believe it's at 438 of the joint appendix, acknowledged that this was not a steep slope. So it's in his own testimony. Seems like every time you read this, you pick up on something new, and that was something I had completely missed when I was writing the brief, but that's actually in the record, as are the pictures. The jury had those things in front of it. You've got not only the text messages here, which are consistent with someone going out there intending to kill, you've got the phone calls, including one that was roughly a half hour before that has very ominous language in it. Again, you've got the text messages, you've got the testimony of the other individuals in this case, and I think as the Commonwealth pointed out, that there's a lot said about the fact that this woman, whose first name was Chastity, Couch, I believe was her last name, was a stripper, had a prior felony record, and so on and so forth, which of course doesn't disqualify her to testify. That's generally all weight issues. And there were aspects that were corroborated by other evidence in the case, including the fact that the victim in this case had told the police, this came in without objection, that the defendant might have stuck a gun to his head. He wasn't entirely sure what the object was, but that's what he thought happened. The defendant himself admitted to some fairly violent physical altercations that preceded this. So there were certainly a fair amount of evidence corroborating what Ms. Couch testified in the case, and certainly one of the biggest things in the sufficiency analysis here, again, obviously, is the testimony of the medical examiner about how the defendant's version is not consistent with the forensic evidence in the case.
Mr. Jeffrey, you're well into your last minute, so if you could wrap it up for us, please.
Yes, sir. I'll simply finish by saying that in terms of the sufficiency of the evidence, that the finding below was not plainly wrong or without evidence to support it, and I would ask the court to affirm the judgment.
Very well. Thank you very much to all counsel. Your case is submitted, and you'll be hearing